take five geeks, add several pints of beer, mix in a dollop of cynicism and a sprinkling of anger, and you have this, the Tux Radar Podcast. This is Season 5, Episode 7. I'm Mike Saunders.
I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Efrain Hernandez.
I'm Ben Everard.
And I'm Graham Morrison.
Fantastic. And in this episode, we have news about the Firefox OS phones. They're going on sale. Canonical is up to some antics. They're stopping to offer DVDs. We have our discovery of the week / Fortnite. We have the amazing halfway reminder, which I'm really looking forward to. We have, of course, our challenge report. We've been using KDE4 for a while. And, of course, Andrew's spectacular open ballot section. If you love this podcast, which naturally you do, then you will love Linux Format Magazine that we work so hard on. Well, mostly the rest of the guys, actually. But you can subscribe to it at tinyurl.com/LXF1.
Offer one.
Oh, yeah. You think we'd know that by now.
Oh, okay, yeah.
We haven't changed the URL.
Really?
For, 18 months.
Oh, okay. So my brain changed instead then. Anyway.
Also, thanks to everybody leaving those lovely kind reviews on Google Play.
Yeah.
We really, really appreciate it.
Mm. There's 100.
100 reviews, really?
Yeah, it must be the best rated magazine on Google Play.
Excellent.
It's the best magazine on Google Play.
It is the best magazine on Google Play.
And there are no reviews from Susie Denmark there, I presume.
I haven't checked.
Fantastic. Well, let's go into the news. Who does the news?
The news.
Ben.
Okay, this Fortnite, the first item, we've got Firefox OS. The phones were released yesterday, or the day before yesterday, depending on when you're listening to this.
I have already made excuses that we're not going to get a chance to edit this until Friday, even though we're recording on Thursday.
Ah, okay.
Because well, I haven't got the time to go to the pub after this.
That's true, yeah. Sorry, this is all my fault, but anyway. So,
happy day after Anzac Day.
Yes. Mm. And happy day after Firefox OS release day. if you're not unaware, it's a new phone operating system by Mozilla. It's built entirely around web technology, so it's all HTML5, it's all JavaScript, it's all open, it's built on top of the Linux kernel. And so they've created these phones. Geeks Phones, a company that made them, and they sold out. I don't know, I went on their website, and a couple of hours after they released, I mean, their website was sort of struggling under the load and kept crashing.
Wow.
And they're sold out today.
Geeks Phones?
Geeks Phone.
Are they rebadging existing phones, or are they actually getting them, like, made in China or something?
They're getting them made in China. I would imagine they're very slightly different from existing phones.
Yeah, I see.
And they have made a few phones before, Android ones.
Oh, okay.
They're 91 euros and 140 euros or something without tax, and you have to add on tax and delivery, which knocks it up. And you need a VAT number as well to order them. Or you did need a VAT number, so I sort of made one of them up, put all the details in. And I think it came to about 150 euros, 160 euros for the cheapest one, all in.
Mm. What kind of spec have they got?
Not terrible. They got the low-end one, the Kion, I think they pronounce it. It's got a 1 gig Snapdragon single core processor, 1/2 gig of RAM, 4 gig of storage, 3.5 inch screen. The other one's got the same storage, a dual core 1.2 gig Snapdragon processor, and I think a 4.3 inch screen.
So good for the price.
Yeah. Firefox, it's been said time again, they're starting with low end phones, so there's no real surprise. Yeah. The specs, but yeah,
I'm interested to see the performance of the applications, though, given that everything's built on these web technologies. You know, they're really going this route, aren't they? I wrote What on Earth about Firefox OS a few months ago.
Oh yeah, I remember that well.
Oh, thanks, Graham. But the idea is they want to introduce all these APIs, don't they?
They
will eventually make their way into all other phones, so that you can interface with cameras and microphones and things using web APIs, not without them to do a native app. So.
Yeah, I mean, I chatted to one of the developers about the performance issue, Fosdem, and he said that it really wasn't an issue that it's built on JavaScript, because even though JavaScript's a bit slow, it's not that much slower now. But the things that take time, it's all the same. Once you've got WebGL, it doesn't make any difference if you're accessing it from JavaScript or from C.
Yeah,
bottleneck's still the GL. It's the same with all the network and et cetera. So all the bottlenecks are the same bottlenecks that you have on any other device. So the fact it's built on web technologies didn't make that big an effect on the performance.
Hmm.
But I haven't had a chance to play with one myself, so I don't know.
Ben, what were the mini burgers like at the Firefox OS phone launch?
No mini burgers.
In that case, I proudly proclaim that Ubuntu Phone OS is better than Firefox Phone.
Well, actually, I say that. I didn't go to the launch. I saw it. I don't think they've done a launch, actually.
Well, what are they playing at? You can't launch something without not having a launch. It's not officially launched, does it?
They were selling them, and then they stopped selling them.
I don't think they even exist. They don't have a launch.
No mini burgers means no phone.
Sponsored by Canonical.
As we said, you can't actually buy these Geeks phones anymore because they've sold out. But Sony has released a ROM for the Xperia E, which is one of their smartphones that retails in the UK about £120, depending on where you buy it from.
Why has Sony done this?
Why would Sony? You don't expect that from Sony.
Yeah, I mean, they're rumoured to be releasing one, and this is sort of a test bed for them.
Oh. Okay.
I don't know.
But they say that you can actually install the operating system on an old Android phone as well.
As far as I'm aware, no one's released official images for anything other than Sony and Geek's phone. You can have a crack at installing it on an old Android phone if you want. It's too soon to be much sort of support around there. I'd imagine in the next year or so, a lot like the CyanogenMod ones will, and an equivalent will spring up for Firefox OS. So, moving on from Firefox, Canonical, it's not linked this fortnight. I didn't have time to do it. Been a busy morning. But on an entirely unrelated, Canonical have released Raring Ringtail today, the latest incarnation of the Ubuntu line. But it's not going to sell after this release.
I think it includes this release.
Yeah. It's not going to sell DVDs for the non-LTS versions.
So that's the end of an era. I mean, it was a couple of years ago they stopped sending out the discs for free.
Yeah.
Now...
Although they never sent them to me. I filled that in, and they... Nothing.
No?
Very early days, they used to send us a load.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Without
even requesting.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe one of us did. But I remember you used to get a box of Ubuntu DVDs or CDs. I changing times, but also changing attitudes at Canonical, I think, towards their product.
Very much so.
I don't know, I imagine it's just no one orders them anymore. I mean, there are 5 each when you can just download it.
Yeah.
In fact, you can just
buy
Linux.
That's a good argument for the cover DVD, isn't it?
You can buy Linux format, pay an extra £1, and you've got a magazine and a DVD.
Plus, the version of Ubuntu that you get on the front of Linux format has been fixed.
It has been fixed.
Fixed? Tell us more.
It's privacy enhanced. We've got rid of their Amazon searching by default. Oh. What's it? You can actually download it now from TuxRadar. We put it on this morning.
Wow.
Or 2 days ago, depending on when you
first step to having our own Linux distribution, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, in fact, in the issue that's just gone on sale, Ben did create his own distribution with like 100 games on it.
Brilliant. That's something far better than me.
Yeah. Our old disk editor didn't do any of that.
Yeah.
It's rubbish.
You told me I had to do it, you'd beat me.
You never used to beat me, Graham. That was the problem.
That's LXF171. It's on sale in all good WH Smiths and a few good Tescos as well, and Barnes & Noble, and Google Play.
The Ubuntu privacy one would be 172.
Ah, I was wrong. Never mind, ignore me.
Well, I also guess people are not likely to buy DVDs of Ubuntu because they know that Canonical's got a fair bit of money anyway. People will buy like Slackware discs to support Pat. Most Slackware users, I imagine, are pretty geeky enough that they'll just download it the second it comes out, but they'll go and buy the box set from the Slackware store just to support, because it's a one-man operation, you know, whereas they probably look at Mark Shuttleworth with money just pouring out of every...
Poor.
And but not in our direction, just to make that clear. So they probably think, well, we don't need to give Canonical more money. So.
Yeah, you can probably buy unofficial ones for like £2 as well.
Yeah.
I don't know. Mm. I haven't tried. You used to be able to.
I still think that it's more of a shift in emphasis to the LTS releases, whereas these become interim releases.
Especially if they're going to go rolling release or pseudo-rolling release, whatever
it is. Of course, it makes sense. But looking at some of the designs on the covers for the old Ubuntu issues, they look nice. They should have made more of the fact you could buy a CD or a DVD with Ubuntu on.
Do it like the vinyls.
Yeah! You don't need, you keep it in shrink wrapped because you download the ISO. Just that's what I do with CDs these days.
Put it up on your wall.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess having an official product looked good when you take it, or having an actual well-presented disc, like on our magazine, of course. It's nice when you take when you're going to install it on a friend's computer. Say, look, I want to show you a better operating system. If you take them a CDR with some scribbles on, you know, it doesn't look very professional or smart. But if you take them a nicely packaged thing and say, I'm going to give your computer a boost with this.
Yeah.
Or if you do what I do and don't write anything on, and you've got a stack of unmarked CDs, and you've got to look at the back to see how much is burned on each one to try and work out which is which.
3.5 gigs there. Yeah.
Haven't had a chance to play with Ubuntu yet, but I'll definitely install it over the weekend.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I use it for about 5 minutes, but it looks roughly similar. There's no big changes. It's still Unity. It's a bit purpler.
Mm. Have they dumped X yet?
No.
Is that next time?
Well, it's been next time for the past three or four times. Yeah. So.
But that was when it was going to be Wayland.
Yeah.
And now it's Mia.
Yeah.
So, who knows?
Who knows? On other news, BitTorrent has released a sync application service, whichever you want to call it. It's kind of like BitTorrent, not like BitTorrent, like Dropbox, but you don't rely on a central server to send it through. But it works in the same way from a user's perspective. You install it on two computers, you sync directories, you make a change on one, it appears on the other, you can send it everywhere without handing your data over to faceless corporations.
So excellent.
Where is your data stored then? If you upload 5 gigs of stuff to this,
it's not stored anywhere other than on your devices. So if what it does is it syncs between different devices rather than storing it on the cloud.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah. Hmm.
So.
And is it peer to peer just between the two machines, or do other machines in the network help carry the load of distributing it?
As far as I'm aware, it's just peer to peer between the two machines.
Right. Or however many machines you've got thing running on.
And you can do stuff, obviously, like do team folders, you can password protect, it's all encrypted.
Sounds brilliant.
It does.
Have that running on a NAS, you know, and use it exactly like Dropbox.
Exactly, or a VPS.
Yes, yeah.
And, so you don't have Google sniffing through your files and blocking your account because you've got a list of usernames and passwords on there.
Have they re-enabled your account now?
I've actually had a look at what's on my account, and I would imagine it's not long before they block it. All sorts. That's BitTorrent. The BeagleBone Black is a small ARM board. It's quite a famous board, but less famous than the Raspberry Pi. But they've just released a new version, the BeagleBone Black, and it comes in, by my research, at £27.87. Although they say that's $45 on America, that's what it's coming up in the UK. The Raspberry Pi, which they say is $30, is coming up on the same site, Farnell, as $28.07. So Raspberry Pi is no longer the cheapest little ARM board you can get. It's this little fella, the BeagleBone Black.
So does it run a Linux distribution?
Yeah, it's based on Cortex A8, so it's a more modern architecture than the Raspberry Pi. It comes with something called Angstrom Linux, it's like their default one. I've probably mispronounced that, but it will run Ubuntu, it will run a whole bunch of them.
Right. RAM? Is it half a gig?
I can't remember. Did you?
Yeah, it is half a gig. It's about 400 and something. Yeah,
because that's one of the limitations with the Raspberry Pi, isn't it? It's never going to have any more memory.
Yeah, I think it comes with 2 gig storage space and half a gig RAM, as far as I saw.
The Raspberry Pi is not going to have any more memory.
No, because it can't be physically put on top of the SoC stuff.
Oh, I see. Oh, wow.
Hmm. Well, this is what the Raspberry Pi Foundation claimed, but other people, I've seen people link to products that could be replaced with it, but I think it's a cost thing.
Well, I asked Eben and he said it was impossible.
Yeah, that's the official line from the Raspberry Pi Foundation, but people who know far more about it than me have linked to things and said, no, that would work if you wish to use it. But I don't know. It's another option in your armory. Yeah.
We'll have to get one.
Yeah, I mean, the sort of difference between the two, if you're not familiar with them, is basically you can consider a Raspberry Pi a GPU with a little CPU attached. It's all about the graphics processing. The chip is actually taken from a set-top box, so it's all designed, for high-def video playback, that sort of thing. The BeagleBone is based around a proper CPU with, well, a slightly more proper CPU with a small GPU attached. So graphical stuff won't run as well, but you'll have more horsepower for general computing.
Hmm. Little server then, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Cool. Next news item. A while ago, we were talking about the Snoopers Charter, a bill in the UK to try and basically spy on what we're doing on the internet and save it for the police to have a look through and work out what we're doing and try and arrest everyone.
Find the terrorists.
Oh, sorry, find the terrorists. Mm-hmm. So Nick Clegg, our Deputy Prime Minister, has said that Snoopers Charter isn't going to happen. The idea that there would be a record kept of all your online activities, something, it just won't happen while the Lib Dems are in government. Of course, we need to support the police. They have significant powers already, which I support them in using. So there we go. It's a good job we can trust what the Lib Dems say and then don't have a strong track record of going back on promises.
That's excellent, isn't it, students?
Yeah. Their word is their bond.
Yes.
The graven tablets come down from the mountain.
Did he say while the Lib Dems are in power?
While they're in government.
While we're in the vicinity of Westminster.
In case any of our international listeners are wondering what a deputy prime minister is, we don't know either. As far as we're aware, he just makes the tea.
He'd have been more useful if he had made the tea.
Speaks good Spanish. But
so
does Effie.
Okay.
The final bit of news on the agenda is that Fuduntu will be no more.
But with a name like that, I mean...
It was a rubbish name.
It gave all sorts of people all sorts of ideas. In fact, I remember mentioning it, I think, in this podcast when they had their first announcement ever. I think it was on my rants bit, but yeah. What happened to it? Why did it die?
Basically, it's always been GTK2, GNOME 2, GTK2 distribution. They've just said too many apps aren't GTK2 anymore.
Oh, okay.
Everyone's going GTK3. The developers didn't want to... Well, I think a lot of the developers are sort of starting again.
Oh, and they didn't want to move to systemd as well, did they? That was one of their other beefs, so... But if they make another distro, please, just use a name that makes sense.
I remember we had an issue a while ago, because we put it on the covered DVD, and their sort of slogan is Fuduntu, puny name, serious distro. But in their official slogan, they misspell puny. So we had to decide, when putting this slogan on the cover, did we go with how they spelled it, or did we go with it correct? And I think we misspelled it on the cover just to support them.
Oh, man. The things we do.
And that's the news.
Fantastic work, Ben.
Good news.
Which means it's Graham's favourite section.
Oh, thanks, Mike.
Which is discovery of the...
Week Fortnite.
Yeah, fantastic.
Fortnite week, whatever. I've got some awesome ones, and I must say, for tradition, I've gone back to geeky audio stuff. I haven't actually done that for a little while.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? Okay, so you've been saving them up then.
Because everybody fell asleep. I don't mind going first.
If yours are audio discoveries, I'll steal a discovery that you told me about.
Yeah.
Discovered RetroArch. Is it RetroArch?
Yeah.
It's basically, how would you describe it? Sort of an amalgamation of a load of emulation options for old games stuff. But I discovered it on the tablet, on the Nexus 7. And you can install it, download a load of ROMs legally, obviously, even though I don't actually know how you legally download
ROMs. Well, I think you have to extract them from the console in the first place, don't you? Somehow. Get some cartridge ripper or something, yeah.
Sticky tape and a load of wires.
So obviously do that, don't just Google.
There are some sources of legal ROMs.
Oh, I thought it was alright to download them as long as you owned the original cartridge.
In some places, like Sealand.
But this is for playing all those public domain ROMs, isn't it? On the hobbyist.
There are people
are still writing games from the NES today.
Get your ROMs however you wish. And you download it and basically, it converted my Nexus 7. It looked a bit like a Game Boy, but I could play SNES games on it. So I was playing Street Fighter and Mario Kart, Super Mario Kart, whatever it was, Game Boy style on the on the Nexus 7.
Does it work with a touchscreen, though? I've got a Nexus 7 as well, and I'm just sort of wondering if...
Yeah. You lose a little bit because you don't have the tactile feel of the button, so it's easy if you sort of thumb to go a bit off.
Slide off, yeah.
It's actually not too big an issue.
Yeah.
With a bit of practice.
Cool.
The great thing about RetroArch is that it's all the old emulator backends that have been re-engineered into a library. So they've not re-engineered emulations. They've used things like SNES 9S, X, and BSNES, and their libraries. You can choose to switch between the backends.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and to keep the front end consistent.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really good.
I love the emulation scene now. It's just getting better and better, you know.
I was telling Ben that I'd added RetroArch to my arcade machine.
Oh, yeah.
Just at the weekend. So that we could play Mario Kart.
Fantastic.
Although I didn't quite get Mario Kart working.
Was it too much of a hassle to tape all the wires onto
the
ROM?
Yeah, that's right.
Extract it legally.
Actually, there's more than enough room inside the arcade machine to put a real SNES in. It's got at least on a PC, RetroArch has got these incredible shaders that you can use. I was telling Ben about this as well, to completely distort and mess up the display. So you can emulate NTSC interference or a really bad cable connection, color distortion, chromatic distortion, scan lines, and it takes up like 100% of both CPU cores on my on my arcade machine. Cool, thanks, man.
Should I go?
I've discovered that apparently telling jokes I'm not really funny. That's one.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Oh, sorry, Effie.
I'm not telling your joke here, American.
You could try one more if you want.
No, I'm not.
Okay.
Never. I discover setting up a network in my house. I recently acquired a NAS, and I've been setting up all the... all the computers attached to it. I never done it for someone that is not as technical as you know already. It's been a challenge, but it's been pretty good. It's been actually just discovering all the little things that you can actually do with a tiny little box.
They're brilliant.
It's a fantastic thing. I've also acquired a new television, a smart television, and now I can finally avoid all this clutter of CDs and DVDs and the stuff like that on the TV cabinet, but just basically working on setting up the network is actually super cool. I never thought I would enjoy it, to be honest, but I spend hours and hours in front of the computer just setting up the network. So thank you very much for all the tips, by the way, guys. That is good. I discovered a game on Android called... I've been looking for a really good zombie apocalypse game on Google Play, and finally found one called Into Death, which is like a first, it's the first person shooter zombie apocalypse. Obviously, the whole place has been run by zombies. You're the only survivor of a helicopter crash, and you land in the middle of the mayhem. And it's really cool. It's a very little bit clunky and doesn't work in many of the mobile devices, but check it out. It's got really good graphics. It's actually quite paced. It's really fast. And it also works by tilting the when you're running around and picking up weapons and so on and so on. I work with tilting the tablet. But it's really fast-paced, and it also works as... it works more as a record... breaking type of game. You have to break your own records. You have to run as fast as you can, avoiding zombies and so on and so on. And it's really cool. It's a lot of fun. It's got a few bugs, and you have to go put through the problem with the ads and so on and so on.
It's free. Just like all those Harry Potter books you once had.
Well, they were free. Hey, they were free. That wasn't my fault.
Yeah. I bet they're not still there now, aren't they? Google Play Store.
I still got them, though.
Yeah,
that is
sticking
it.
Sticking it to the man. The woman.
That's it. That was my discovery.
I've got some discoveries now.
Why do you have to use sexy voice to say the discovery?
It's just my voice. It's good that you think of Andrew in that way.
No, I'm not thinking of quite the opposite.
Stop flirting.
I'll give you my number later.
Well, it is hot in here. I've already got your number is 089150 50 50.
I missed you guys.
Oh yeah. Oh, man. So discoveries then. Discovery number one, Terminator. If you, like me, spend a lot of time with two terminal windows open when you're trying to do something in one window and you're
sort of trying to wade through the man page in the other window, you might like Terminator, which is a terminal emulator.
Wow, I see what they did there.
And you can press a funky key commands and get it split into two panes or three panes or four panes. So it's just neat. And the other thing that I like about it is that I'm reading from Hotpix now.
I've heard of this.
The original X-Term has been in development. This is what Terminator is based on. The original X-Term has been in development since 1984. And 1984 is the year that Terminator, the film, came out.
Interesting.
See what they've done there. That's great. Other discoveries include, are basically non-Linuxy. The North is a ridiculously long way away. That's a discovery. There's still snow up there.
Right.
Shocking. Yes, I was at a wedding at Lanercost at the weekend, which is this lovely medieval priory and abbey, which was it got Cromwellized, and before that it got Henry VIII-erized. But before that it got Robert the Bruce-erized.
Oh.
Apparently he came down with his shortbread and his jolly comedy accent. And by just by having a really nice time, as they do, accidentally managed to set a fire to it and kill a load of the monks.
Oh, well.
So, I guess the discovery there is that, I don't know, Mel Gibson lied to us, and that actually the Scottish people were the baddies.
Yeah, but Robert the Bruce wasn't portrayed at all well in Braveheart, was he? He was portrayed as like a kind of a turncoat at the end.
Yeah,
I don't know much. A traitor.
Yeah,
he's still got the statue outside Edinburgh Castle, though.
Yeah, true.
So there you go. That's marvellous.
Is it my turn?
So if you want.
Well, you know.
Have you discovered anything?
Yeah, I have. Actually, I dug out an old ZX Spectrum 48K the other day, but without a power adapter. And then I dug out Mega Drive 1, also known as the Genesis for our American listeners, and that didn't have a power adapter. And I got a bit stuck, and then I found a power adapter that's compatible with both of them, and it's the Atari Jaguar power adapter. So for all the listeners out there with Atari Jaguars, and I know there's lots of you, like me, then your Atari Jaguar power adapter, I think it gives out 9 volts at 1.2 amps, so, and it's got the right connector as well for ZX Spectrum 48Ks, the rubber key ones, and Mega Drive 1. Don't try with your Mega Drive 2, I don't know.
That's awesome.
But I need to explain why I have an Atari Jaguar in the first place.
That's pretty cool.
Let's be honest.
Is that the handheld thing?
No, that was the Lynx.
That's Atari Lynx.
No, the Jaguar was the 64-bit one. They claimed it was 64-bit and it was all do the math. They brought it out just before, about 93. And then it was really bad at 3D, and then, you know, the PlayStation came out, and Atari couldn't market their way out of the paper bag, and it came Cybermorph, a terrible game. But I, in about 2002, long after Atari had fallen apart, I was in Reading, and I went into a game store, and they had stacks of these brand new Atari Jaguars piled up for $9.99 each. Wow. So just the geek, retro, emulate, everything bursting in me just said, I've got to buy one of these, I don't know why, but I've got to buy one. And I bought a copy of Doom as well for £7, so it had a reasonable conversion of Doom. But the guy in this game shop said to me, yeah, Atari are making these consoles again. I don't know why he felt the need to say that to me, because it was a very strange thing to say.
Maybe
he thought that they were, so I can't...
He had a dream, it was a very vivid dream.
Yeah, very odd dream, but that's the reason, listeners, why I have an Atari Jaguar. I did not buy one when it was £300. That would have been silly.
Okay, that leaves my discoveries. So the first one is actually a retro tracker, a music tracker.
Octomed.
It's like Octomed,
cool.
But it's got built-in audio engines for retro games consoles and computers.
Oh, wow.
It's got a weird name, though. It's called the Defil Mask. And it only comes as a binary, 32-bit binary. It works just like any other tracker. It's very difficult to describe. You have to actually see a screenshot, see a video of one in motion. But, like, if you take a look at Renoise or something, which is an incredible tracker for Linux, Defil Mask, and it includes Mega Drive, Master System, Game Boy, PC Engine, NES, and C64 emulation, plus some Yamaha chips. And that's built into each lane, so you can create real chiptune music just as they would with a sound engine that creates the sounds automatically.
Wow.
Which is really cool. I can't believe people actually develop these things and never hear about them.
Chiptune music is quite popular, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So
it kind of falls, yeah. But with Renoise, for example, you could use an external kind of synth because Renoise has MIDI, and you can also have software instruments in there.
Right.
But it's still cool. It's free.
But just a quick sort of question on this. Can anybody emulate the C64 sound as good as a real SID chip?
Oh, well, you know the answer to
this. I know the answer to that, but is it really true that a proper SID chip is just a whole other league?
Well, the thing with the SID chip is that there's part of it, most importantly, is that the filter, and it's an analog circuit. Mm. And so
that's the reason, isn't it?
One of the oscillators are digital, so the actual sound source is a digital waveform. It then gets translated into analog audio, and that analog audio runs through the actual circuit of the chip going through an analog filter, and the tolerances of the manufacturing process meant that the filters were different in each batch in each week, and also they all age differently, so they all sound differently.
It's
almost
cool,
impossible
yeah.
to accurately emulate that, although people have put a lot of effort into it.
And they're extremely rare, aren't they, SID chips? I know you've
well, a SID chip with a working filter is difficult to get hold of.
Yeah.
They're even copied in China.
You know,
you can even get new SID chips where, but people get obsessed with them. They prefer one batch over another batch, or 1 year over another year.
Cool. Like wine.
SID chips are awesome. They make an incredible sound.
Maybe we should link to an example, some
chiptune music with
chip-tune
a SID chip.
Music, yeah, just.
Yeah. Yeah, well, everybody knows the sounds of a C64, I think. You know, even if you didn't have one, you know what they sound like. So the other thing is another audio effect. And called Glitch, and it's Glitch 2.0, which is a VST plugin. VST is like the big instrument plugin format for Windows. But there's a native version of VST for Linux using the same API, which lots of. I can see where this is going now. I'm just talking on my own.
Do you want me to keep? Yeah.
Yeah. No. It's okay.
Really?
This is why I didn't have any audio discoveries for a while. Anyway, it's a VST plugin, and it sounds awesome. What it does is you sequence between 9 different effects that sound like delays and reverse and tape machine emulation. There's a Linux version. I think it's great that these people create Linux versions of effects.
Awesome.
It's great. It sounds like the Aphex Twin in about 1998. It makes all your music. In fact, it would turn the podcast into an Aphex Twin track. and I've got another one. I've rediscovered IRC.
Oh yeah.
After being away from IRC for many, many years, I don't know why. I got into it again.
Specific channel, or is it?
Well, no, because Linux format's pretty disappointing. That's why I was mentioning it.
I think I'm still the op on.
Yeah,
that.
You are.
On the op, so we should probably do something.
I'm now on Linux format's channel most of the time.
Oh, I might pop in there.
Yeah, pop in. I keep it open on a window now. I tried a load of clients last week and ended up using a Cursor-based console one called WeChat. Which is completely awesome. It's really good, mainly, as I said, in the office, because it looks really technical. So people who walk past my screen looks like I'm serious.
Yeah.
But
and you're not just arguing on Ash Ubuntu.
It's a console-based IRC client, and you can split the panels vertically, horizontally, do all kinds of stuff. It's got inline spell checking, which is essential for me.
On the console as well? That's
pretty using
cool.
Aspell. So WeChat, IRC, join us on Linux format on Freenode.
Freenode hash Linux format, yeah?
Yeah. Mm. They're my discoveries. They are our discoveries of the fortnight, and that is that.
That's the best discovery of the fortnight I've presented in a while. Fantastic. That brings us to the halfway point of this podcast. Still to come is the results of our KD4 challenge. And, of course, Andrew's got
lots
of...
It sounds so formal, doesn't it? When you do it.
Does it?
Yeah, it does. It's like Michael Parkinson is...
I'll sort of cough and splutter. I think Andrew's got something to talk about. Where am I? I'm confused. A challenge.
Challenge us? Oh, well, who should we do?
Well, we've only just started doing the challenges, haven't we? So it doesn't really have a...
We've kind of tried to resurrect the challenges because they're a good idea, but we've been pretty rubbish at keeping up with them. Although, it looked like... I know Ben actually has been using KD. I've been using KD.
I used it a bit at home actually.
Wow, that was a serious business.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what did you think? Do you still think it's terrible?
When I first installed it, I thought it was awful. And then after about 2 days of you pointing me out to set stuff up, it's okay. But it's just that ridiculous amount of time you need to sort of create something not rubbish.
Watching you trying to configure it, I realised that the default values for the things that they choose and the way that they hide some of the settings is insane.
Yeah.
It's insanely stupid.
And the names given to, well, I guess it's not a core case, but it's like that drop-down terminal thing. You're like, oh, it's UA
Yeah,
core quick.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, oh, just give stuff a sensible name so you can remember what it is.
Yeah.
I think what my experience is that it does look scary when you start using it. You don't know where things are, how to edit the desktop and so on, how to set it up. But what I do like of it is that it's almost organic. It's almost like what the experience that you might have in a tablet. You're moving things around and it actually reacts quite vividly. That's what I think is really nice about it. It's the amount of effort that they put into making it really, I don't know, kind of organic and alive.
Yeah.
But I do like it. I think it's good.
I mean, I switched over to KD wholesale. It's not just a desktop environment, but I used the Caligra Office Suite.
Oh, wow.
And I tried to just do everything. And the only thing that I just couldn't get on with, it wasn't me not getting on with it, it was the other things. It was Reconk. There's just too many websites that rendered badly. And
What engine does it use, Reconk?
It's KHTML, so yeah. It's WebKit. Basically, but it's obviously not the same way.
Is it an old version or something, anything?
I don't know the full history of it all, but I just found that it regularly would render things incorrectly.
Strange, yeah. You think, you know, WebKit browsers are a bit the same with WebKit.
Yeah, I think for a long time it used KHTML, they were really stubborn, and it's only last 12 months or 18 months they moved to WebKit.
Right, yeah.
It's a pity considering the heritage of KHTML.
It's kind of funny, isn't it? It goes back in a loop like that, yeah. So.
Qt Web is quite a good browser, but it's not an official KD browser.
But it still integrates well and looks nice and all of that, I guess, from the name.
Yeah. I guess I use Chrome, just like most people.
I didn't get as far as you, Ben, in using all the KD desktop applications. I just use the same ones that I know and trust. And they're mostly GTK apps and they all just look rubbish. I know, I'm aware that you can go through various theming processes and stuff, but I just can't be bothered. I can't be bothered to spend the time to set it up, especially hearing you and hearing the howls of anguish.
Yeah,
from the side
of
the desk.
Just trying to do something simple, like getting rid of the blue glow or the blue drop shadow that surrounds the windows by default. It is impossible. You can't do it.
Yeah, and there's still some stuff I haven't got around to setting up properly. Like now, when I go through, I'm in Dolphin, and I click on a text file or a config file, it opens it in LibreOffice.
Nice.
Even like Python files and stuff, I have to right-click. And I know that it's in there somewhere, but I just haven't got the energy to go in and find out where it is.
I have something similar on my machine at the moment. Whenever I try and download an ISO file in Firefox, it offers to open it in Vim. Yep, that's just what I want to do with a 600 megabyte binary file. Look at it in Vim. Yeah.
You mean that's not how you put the disk together?
Yeah, that's why. This is why you're so much better than me.
Replace Ubuntu with macOS and you're done.
I think it is the most configurable desktop I've ever seen. I mean, it is unbelievably configurable. And I know, similar to Ben, I know I could spend a long amount of time setting it up exactly as I like, but... And, you know, so I don't think KDE is bad per se, but it reminds me, when I started using Linux, everyone was using FVWM, and that is enormously configurable as well through a giant config file. And I started using IceWM. Everyone was like, well, that just looks a bit like Windows, you know, 95 style. You can do this with FVWM if you learn all these options. And I saw like 800 line configuration files for FVWM. I thought, I just don't have time or the inclination to learn all that. You know, I know with FVWM I could do anything, but I just didn't want to. Sometimes you just want to use something out of the box.
Yeah.
And it also sort of traps you into that distro and that installation once you've done that.
Yeah.
You don't want to change or try something new because you spent so long.
You do a fresh installation and then you realise you've got to spend another 2 days reconfiguring every KDE thing to your liking. Yeah.
Is there scope for a fixed KDE to go on the disk?
There is.
Yeah. I don't know if we're going to have the time because I've got to do it tomorrow.
Right.
Today.
Cool. That would be nice.
It would be nice.
Tune in to WHList to find out whether we do that.
But actually, I was going to say, there were a couple of things I did genuinely like about KDE. And one of them was in the Caligra suite, I think it's just called Caligra Words, the word processor. The layout of it is a lot nice because, you know, LibreOffice basically just apes an earlier version of Microsoft Office. But this one, they've got the setting down the side. So on general monitor, your page is wider than your text. So rather than dumping stuff at the top, which is taking screen space away from where I'd view my text, it puts it all down the side.
That makes sense.
So you can see things like your statistics, you know, what your readability is, what your word count is down the side. You can do your formatting down there. And it's just a much nicer layout, I thought.
I think they can be a bit more daring like that, can't they? LibreOffice has basically got to ape, like you say, Microsoft Office, because people expect that. But given that Caligra is not so widely used, it can probably be more imaginative.
Yeah. There were some other things I liked, but I wrote them down and forgot to bring the piece of paper.
Follow up next episode.
Do you like all the energy that your finger saves by only having to click on things once rather than twice?
No, it really annoys me because I have to click around three times because I click to select it and then it opens it, and I have to close the thing it opened, then try and get a little green cross to select it. That really annoys me, actually. I don't want to click a tiny little green cross I can barely. Everything's too small on KDE. It's too fiddly.
It is by default, isn't it? Yeah, I never get that. The default themes and everything is very.
When everybody's saying these things, they're looking at me.
Fix it, Graham. Fix it.
Like, I'm sorry for your loss.
So that sounds pretty comprehensive.
Yeah.
Mm. Really. What next?
I know. So I just feel I've been quite negative about KD, but I actually did quite like it. I should point that out.
I think, yeah, we were talking about it and talking about doing a Linux format version, and I think the distributions have really let KDE down. We said this before, because somebody really needs to take ownership over the way the newbie experiences it. Get rid of all the options and create a decent default.
Especially something like Ubuntu. I mean, I used it on Ubuntu just because I had an Ubuntu install already. And that should be the newbie-friendly version. It's Ubuntu. It's what people see. They should make it just nice.
Yeah, yeah. That's what distributions exist to do.
Yeah.
And that's all the weather.
So we need another challenge.
We need another challenge. And by coincidence, we have the current issue, which is actually 171, open at the 50 distros tested page. And we've got an awesome Tux Radar Linux format distro picker of Tron.
Yeah, yeah. Ben did this awesome distro picker in JavaScript. We've put it live this morning. It's really good. Yeah. It's uncanny.
Well, how does it work?
Magic. Just JavaScript doodaddery, to be honest. I'd rather not explain it.
Do you like type in what you want to do?
No, there's a load of like sliders. So if you want to how much you want, like GNOME, how much you want KDE, whether or not you want, I don't know, latest versions or stable versions or
older new hardware.
Yeah.
Great.
And then you pick get distro and it tells you what your perfect distro is.
But it works.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean,
it suggested
initially Gen 2 and then Arch.
Okay.
Which is pretty accurate. Yeah.
I'll have to try it.
So that's doing that. It may possibly be available as an Android app.
Cool.
Depending on whether or not Google let it in.
You want to try and get it installed by default in some distros. It's sort of crazy loop.
The next time we'll need a new challenge. And why don't we pick one of these? Why don't we really try a new distro, but rather than just what we did last time where we all swapped around, why don't we pick one at random from our 50 best distros tested feature?
Cool. Great idea.
Okay, so I'll close my eyes. And point.
And you really is.
Yeah, and then someone, if you can read them out. Oh, we can have the wheel soundtrack as well.
Yeah, we've still got the wheel. It's in your shed, I think.
I have still got the wheel, yeah. There's still Grub 2 on it.
Just here.
Maybe that's what we'll get.
Tell you what, I'll use the pen because it's more accurate.
Close your eyes.
And who am I picking for now?
I don't know. Pick me.
Okay, pick Graham.
Pick me.
So Graham is going to be using
number 28,
Frugalware.
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 Congratulations.
Great.
Well done.
Wow.
And Ben.
Doesn't sound like KDE.
K Frugalware.
Yeah, it only takes like half an hour to install and you can just use it.
And Ben.
Get the
pen
out.
Yeah.
Ortios.
Okay.
Pronounce
Ortios.
I don't even know that.
Ortios. No, it's. I don't. I think you can install it on a desktop, but it's designed to be portable, so you put it onto a flash drive.
Even more fun.
How about the one above Ortios then? Pear.
I'll use Pear.
Linux.
Cool. Pear. And for you, Effie.
Just go for it.
Remove
the pen. Ubuntu.
Ubuntu.
I'm already using Ubuntu.
That's a. What should we choose again?
Yeah, choose again.
I'll choose again.
You could use the latest Raring Ringtail and let us all know what it's like.
All right.
Yeah, fine. That's a huge win. And I'm going to use that one.
Is it the same one?
Yeah.
No.
Foresight Linux. Wow. That's exciting.
Yeah.
Should we do you want one, Mike?
Yeah, just for the lulls. I'm going to use. Depending.
I missed.
He missed.
How about that?
Okay.
Does that work?
What is it? Watt OS. I have heard of Watt OS before, but I don't know anything about it.
It's brilliant. A really low power OS. It's similar to sort of a puppy type thing.
Yeah?
Yeah, really stripped back.
Great. I'll try and get it running on my Atari Jaguar.
It made it.
Yeah.
We'll let you know how our Voyage of Discoveries fare next week, fortnight, on Tux Radar.
Tune in. But that only leaves one thing, and we always say we save the best till last. So let's go to the pub. Lols. It is the open ballot.
So it's time for the open ballot. Would you pay for Linux? That's the question we asked.
That's almost a ballot-like question.
Yeah.
It lends itself to yes-no answers, and the overwhelming trend was yes.
Wow, I'm surprised.
I got halfway through and I just stopped counting.
Really pleasantly surprised.
Yeah. Most people were quite happy to give a little bit of something back.
I don't want to rain on anything, but I found it really interesting. A lot of people said they would pay, but only because...
Yes.
They're not asked to pay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry if that was a big conclusion you're leading up to.
So let's go to the pub. All right then. So let's start with the naysayer. Just because there's only one of him, and that's Alistair, who's probably feeling a little bit cheap. No. Probably that's why he's not verified, but Alistair says there is absolutely no way I would pay for something that is open source. That's not to say I wouldn't pay for a rebuilt binary or for software though.
Or for software.
Oh, or for support, sorry.
Ah, okay.
I saw a word that began with S and I just filled in my tiny brain filled in.
Couldn't
the
blanks. Bothered reading the rest of it.
In contrast, Toey71 says, people pay for games, so why not pay for a stable, secure platform to play these games on? I would happily pay an annual sub to somebody to keep on working on my distro of choice, but how would that work? I happily pay for you guys to produce the magazine, don't I?
It's true, yeah.
Yeah.
Him and Canonical.
You mean Blue Systems.
Yeah. If you think we are sponsored by Canonical, you've not been listening recently.
Right. That brings us... So, the yes or no thing, most people said yes. Only a couple of people said no.
Some great responses.
Yeah, really, really good. I've got a brief selection now, but if you've got the time, I strongly recommend you go over to tuxradar.com/whatever it is and read all of the words, because there are some really good words there.
True. Ones that we didn't write as well. Yeah.
They're the best words. Xiao says, I don't pay for free software. However, if I won the lottery, I have Mint and KDE in mind to donate to. If everyone... But this goes on, right? This gets better. If everyone did pay for Linux, however, I would expect that GNOME 3 would either never have happened or would have been given a lukewarm reception. Unity would probably be dead, good riddance, because no one would have paid for it. Very few people wanted it, or GNOME 3, or KDE 4 for that matter. If money drove Linux development, there would be pretty much no real movement on new software.
See, that comment confused me. I couldn't work out if you were saying that was a good thing or a bad thing.
Because it's a bit of both, I suppose.
Yeah.
You seem to suggest we might have avoided, you know, with a bit of sort of payment feedback, and might have avoided completely trashing GNOME and changing it completely. Whereas on the other hand, when he says there'd be no progress, I think there still would be progress. I don't know, yeah.
Well, maybe it would be, you know, like, you know, oh God, I almost, what words are trying to come out of my mouth now?
I mean, obviously Microsoft wouldn't do something crazy like completely change their and risk upsetting their users.
Good point, yeah.
On a similar point to Hyauge, Adam says, modern distros are almost certainly worth paying for, but would they have reached this level if we'd had to pay for them from the start? It's one of those things that's now hard to bring in retrospectively. If you had to pay for Ubuntu, what guarantee that the benevolent dictator wouldn't use the money to pursue his own vanity projects? Yes. So apparently there is an example, of at least theoretical example, of how capitalism might not lead to innovation. Yes, great. Tex says, I might consider paying for a distro either directly or in the form of a donation, if and only if it were completely my property and released under a free software license. I would never pay for a distro which required a EULA. And Omniferious Implementer says, I pay $20 per annum to my distro of choice to help pay for bandwidth, but I'd be more than happy to pay that for a license. Now, licensing, it's not the same as paying for software. How do we feel about paying for a license?
No.
No, I don't either.
No.
Yeah.
Well, my attitude's changed. I think if it was the late 90s, I wouldn't have paid for Linux, other than buying the discs off a magazine to get hold of them. But you know, I've just been playing with VPSs recently and raised tickets with them, and I kind of expect a certain level of service. Even though I'm paying next to nothing, it would be nice to get that kind of experience with a distribution. Nothing to do with the software being free or non-free, but actually be enrolling in that kind of level of support, even for normal customers. And also, it would be great to give something back. I mean, imagine how great Mint would be if all of its users were paying £5 a year to use it. You know, they'd have some serious money to be able to make a firm commitment to the future. There's all kinds of things that it would be nice if it was, you know, you could, their distribution systems generated a custom distribution just for you with your name on, you know, that kind of stuff. I know anybody could do it, but that kind of extra service makes it feel really good.
I mean, I was thinking about, like you say, about licensing, and you could do it in quite a cool humble bundle style way. You pay, and if you pay above the average, maybe you get something a little bit flashy, like your name somewhere or something. And obviously it's DRM free, no licenses or whatnot.
Yeah, maybe a distro where the more you paid, the more input you had into it might work. You know, like the Frontier, the Elite Kickstarter thing. You know, people who paid lots got to have dinner with David Braben so they could poke him and say, oh, you should put this in. But I used to pay for Linux loads, but back before I had any decent sort of internet, I used to buy the giant SUSE box sets with like six CDs and giant manuals. It was like Christmas every time those came.
Why is it almost everyone I speak to bought the SUSE box set? I bought SUSE as well.
But I did buy the Red Hat one at one point and Mandrake, but the thing is, it's just those were both really small, and you had like two or three discs and a couple of little manuals. I think everybody got aware, because SUSE used to advertise as well these giant box sets in like PC Plus. So everybody semi into Linux was aware that the biggest thing you can get through the post at the time was a giant, massive SUSE box set straight from Germany, and it just felt like, yes, it's going to keep me going.
I only threw mine out actually when I moved down here to start this job. It took up like 2 foot of bookshelf.
And you can't really sell them, can you? I mean, maybe there'll be collector's items one day, but they're just big and heavy and bulky.
And I think it was 7 CDs and a DVD.
In a giant like wallet that skated out, didn't it?
Those wallets were really cool, actually, with the stacks of discs on either side.
Yeah. It felt good, because, when all you had was no internet, or just dial-up. You said, I'm going to spend weeks exploring this, you know, finding.
And then it was, you didn't generally have software, you couldn't just apt-get because you didn't have the internet,
Yeah.
Or well, whatever their SUSE equivalent was. And just to have all that software, it was a mind-blowing amount of software on that disk.
And it was more than just software as well. I remember finding on their big collection of mod music as well. So it just randomly, just going through the disk, found some, you know, public domain mods that they'd got from some FTP server. And it was like, it was like the internet coming through the post.
It was,
you know?
Yeah.
So there.
Them were the days.
All this were fields.
Going back to the humble bundle approach, a couple of comments here. Yoda says, I like the canonical approach. The OS is free, but you can choose to donate or to buy services. I'll donate on Thursday when I download, and I'll continue to subscribe to Ubuntu One. And it's Mr. Penguin, thank you, not verified, says, I have no problem with paying for distribution. The problem to me seems that it is how the monies are distributed, particularly among the programmers who contribute their time to the advancement of the distribution. Blah, blah, blah. Some of the distributions actually want server space and bandwidth rather than finance to bring the fruits of their work to the public. If we had to, currently CentOS is in a similar situation. If we had to pay for Linux, I would like a percentage going towards the base of Linux, for example, the kernel, with the rest of the money being a user choice as to how the rest is split among the components that make up distribution, just like the humble indie bumble. This method can then be used to produce statistics on what is popular among the users. Mm. Also,
good idea. That's a great idea.
It's a great idea.
Imagine that with Slider, with KDE and GNOME.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There is the risk that it's all going to go to like the user-facing stuff and all the sort of back-end stuff.
Yeah, but there's nothing stopping it carrying on like before.
Yeah.
This is extra money.
That's true, yeah.
Also, Mr. Penguin signs off with saying, also, I'm Yorkshire, so I am tighter than a chav with their last bottle of Frosty Jack. Linux Linuxson has got a good idea for the next Uderas.
Yeah.
He says, I would willingly sell me house and all my possessions to help my distro of choice. I dare the Linux Format crew to do the same. Sadly, we've stopped doing Uderas, so although we'd love to.
And to be honest, I think my landlord would be really annoyed if I did that.
If you sold his house.
And blamed it on that guy.
Spanguages has quite a long comment here, which is...
He hasn't got another phrase for me to pronounce.
No, he's not. But this just goes to show why it's worthwhile going to the actual site comment section and reading it all for yourself. If I can more or less pricey it, like many others, I've paid for Linux on physical media through the post years ago. That's, for example, SUSE. Right, so the point is, perhaps people often think that you get what you pay for, and as such, Linux is the cheap alternative for those who can't afford the real deal. This would be OS X or Windows 8, 7, Vista. People are not used to living in a world where free stuff is any good. So yes, perhaps a price tag might act as a seal of quality. And he's put in brackets, I'm only talking about attracting new non-technical users here. I think he's got a really good point there. I like it. As the price charged for it, not as a way of generating revenue, but as a marketing tool.
Reassuringly expensive.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Or like, what was it? Nick always used to blether on about Irish whiskey, which for years and years was cheaper than Scotch whiskey, and so no one bought it because they thought it must be rubbish. And then they put the prices up massively, and suddenly, hey, let's get Jameson's and Paddy and Black Bush, yes.
Yeah. But a few distros have tried that, and it generally hasn't worked brilliantly well for them.
Well, Linspire, did that not used to be a paid-for one? And Turbo Linux was paid for.
Turbo, yeah, I remember
but
that
was,
reviewing
but
that.
But it was rubbish. It was rubbish and it was 40 quid.
Yeah, I think that's the problem. I remember the Mandriva had this like super mega power pack, or when it was Mandrake, I think, you know, and you got everything included then. It bundled codecs and stuff, and that was sort of a premium-priced product, but... You know, they always have their financial troubles, didn't they?
So. And Zorin's trying it at the moment. They have the base one that's free, and then you have you know, business or educational ones for, I think it's only like €9 or something.
€9 makes more sense as a price for something that you can get a free alternative to.
Yeah.
Because it might take you maybe, depending on what your broadband's like, it might take you half an hour to download an ISO and then another half an hour to install it. So... You want to price it at an hour's labour, because that's the real cost of it. So €9 is cheap.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's expensive, but I'm saying I don't think they're selling many of them at all.
Yeah, okay. Only a couple more. Oh, Spangwidges again.
Huh?
Have I copied and pasted them twice?
Oh, is that allowed?
Oh, no. Down with Spangwidges. Oh, no, here we go. People buy Red Hat being fully aware of the existence of CentOS and Scientific Linux, etc., because they value the service they get on top of the product. I think this is a difficult approach to transfer to a domestic environment since home users are less willing to pay a support contract.
Mm.
Yes.
Fair point.
Stuart says, payment means control. If I pay for Linux, that implies that there is an entity that controls the software. While I agree that some more money in the pockets of those involved in Linux would help, the handing over of the control to enable payments would not be a good thing. And Rezen says, ever since switching to Linux, I've done a lot less pirating and a lot more donating to distros and projects alike. The system we have going works well for Linux and Humble Bundle, Kickstarter projects, etc. No DRM and a possibly modest fee, if any at all. I look forward to donating to Linux Mint again in the near future, come next release.
I like the way he says, less pirating. He's still pirating.
Less much pirating.
Thanks, awesome. Andrew. That was a good one. I think it was a great podcast all around, wasn't it? I think we can be proud of this. Yeah.
Despite it's so hot in here, it really is hot.
It's
just Andrew.
Yeah.
that's Effie. He's getting hot sitting next to me. Effie's getting hot sitting next to me because of my apparently sexy voice.
You heard it here first, listeners. Yeah, so thanks everybody. We'll be back again in 2 weeks.
Just one last thing.
Yeah.
Who are you?
Oh yeah, I'm the old you.
The old me.
You're the new me.
Ah.
Yeah. There was some sort of transfer of like mind melding or something that went on. What's it like to be me?
Exhilarating.
Yeah. It's a non-stop roller coaster ride, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
Thanks, Ben. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.